children. Hi, and welcome to Cartwheels on the Sky, Poets, Poems, and Discovery. I'm your host, Blake Moore, and for the next 30 minutes, you're going to get a glimpse into the poems and process of Albion poet Karen Lewis. Before I share our conversation, I want to tell you a bit about Karen. Karen Lewis lives between Salmon Creek and the Navarro River on unceded ancestral land of the Pomo people. Her work navigates themes of migration, war, peace, love, loss, ecology, and motherhood. Her new chapbook, Peace Maps, explores these territories and is available through Gallery Bookshop in Mendocino or from Fishing Line Press. Karen holds an MFA from Antioch, Los Angeles, and is taught with California Poets in the Schools and the Arts Council of Mendocino County. When she's not writing, she's tending garden and orchard, foraging in the forest, or scavenging local beaches to remove plastic debris. More information can be found at www.wordjourneys.org. The conversation you're about to hear took place earlier this week.
Well, hi, Karen Lewis. It's really a pleasure to have you with me here on Cartwheels on the Sky.
Thanks, Blake.
So let's start off with a poem.
Great. This is a poem called Summer River. Yellow blossoms cover traces of ash and agate along the trail where he leads us to a secret swimming place. One daughter sings in the language of osprey, and the other whispers to a brown turtle the size of her fist. The turtle crawls across our path and disappears into its ancestral stream. Our shadows crisscross each other. A solitary gray osprey soars to a branch-built nest on top of a lightning-snagged fir. Both daughters splash into the river shallows, pursued by salamander bubble songs. My husband plunges after to keep them safe, while I dream this poem from yellow blossoms and barefoot summer mud.
Thank you. What a beautiful moment in nature that is.
Yeah, it's the nature close by, the Navarro River.
Well, let's just talk about you a little bit, your background, and how you became a poet, or when you finally started calling yourself a poet, your journey to become a poet.
Well, Blake, I think for me it started when I was in middle school, and it was a real tumultuous time, and our language arts teacher was demonstrating. It was the draft for the Vietnam War era. And she brought lyrics from popular songs like Crosby, Stills, and Simon and Garfunkel to class and let us look at those as poetry. And I just loved the idea that poetry could be fragments, it could be little clips of consciousness. It didn't have to have a form like a Shakespearean sonnet.
Right.
I think it was also around that time that I got excited about Gary Snyder's poetry, which was so rooted in nature and a wild landscape and ties to the land, which really called to me because I was living in Los Angeles, going to Los Angeles public schools where there was very little wild nature. So I always kept a journal. When I first thought about publishing poetry, I was a grown-up with two small children and really writing from a place of grief and writing a lot of poetry to process the complex grief that I was going through. And at some point that pivoted to be more joyous of capturing the moments of daily life and looking for ordinary wonders like a butterfly or a spider web that was outside, going on walks and noticing the seasons changes.
It's a beautiful way of putting it, just how we transform. We start with a burning need to express something that then becomes a willingness to co-create with nature of the visuals that we see and just capture those emotional moments.
Right, and it's such an exploration. Poetry and language is such an exploration, the creative process. So it's not so much for me about the answers, it's about the discovery, it's about the journey.
Why don't you read us another poem?
Okay, is it okay to read a student poem?
Of course.
Some of the energy I try to bring into the classroom with poets in the schools is that poetry is a quest, and it's an exciting time to discover and put your discoveries into words. So this poem's by a fourth grader who was a fourth grader last year, J.C. Whitmire, in Fort Bragg at Dana Gray School. And her poem is called My Poem is Hiding. My poem is hiding. My poem is hiding. My poem is hiding in the wild and free horses. My poem is hiding in the leaves in fall upon the wild life. My poem is living in my dreams. My poem is looking for me. And I am looking for it.
Bravo.
And I hope JC is still looking for poems and they're still finding her, because I haven't been in the school for almost a year now.
Yeah, how did you start teaching?
I met Perry Longo in Santa Barbara, who told me about poets in the schools. And I thought, ooh, that's a thing. That sounds really cool. And she said, oh, if you're in Mendocino County, you should reach out to this other Karen, Karen Faulkner. So I did reach out to Karen. And Karen had a big gig, actually, in Point Arena. And she asked if I wanted to shadow her down there. And the first time in the classroom, I just thought, wow, this is an amazing alchemy. And I really want to work with young people, and I want to be in this creative space.
And you've been doing it, how many years is that now?
That might have been around 1995.
Uh-huh.
So is that 25 years, maybe?
Something
it just
like that.
It doesn't really seem like that long, but it's been a wonderful way to get to know so many people in the community who are now grown up, and they'll remember our poetry workshops together. It's a great space to be in the creative classroom. It's wonderful.
It is, isn't it? And it's such an interesting art form to teach because, of course, it's so free form, you know. You don't ever want to squelch anyone's creativity because poetry is kind of all about breaking the rules. But then you also want to teach the rules so then you can learn to know if you're breaking them or not. But I guess the point of all of that is it's still the emotional language, and that's the, it's like you're handing people a key to inside themselves, and they can learn how to turn that key their own way.
You know, that's so true, because there's so many different ways to be creative and to be creative with language. And some students are quite analytical and they want a lot of rules and they want to have a pattern or a form, and other students are willing to just completely go with the flow, and it's all great.
Right.
And I also love how those students respect each other's differences in the classroom and really listen to each other and learn from each other.
And you mostly teach younger students, is that correct?
That seems the way it's been the last several years.
Do you have a favorite grade?
Well, grade 3 and 4 are pretty fun, mostly because most students at that point are fairly confident in their actual writing process, like holding the pencil, et cetera, and are still super creative and willing to explore.
Right.
It's a little challenging with kindergarten because there's a lot of kinetic energy, but not so much ability to translate all the creativity in their minds and hearts to paper.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So we need to have more parent and you know, student teacher helpers for kindergarten.
Yeah, it makes it more challenging, but it is fun. Like you said, I think that one thing, too, is with kindergarten is try not to be too goal or outcome-oriented.
Exactly. It's very much the process, and there's such an element of play at that age. A lot of element of play, and it's a challenge as a visiting teacher to know what will spark the students. For example, they're learning their colors. So if we write poems connected with colors, there's automatically a vocabulary they have. Or if they're doing a nature study project that I know about, automatically they have confidence because they know something that they want to use in their poem.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically success for all, trying to find a topic that everyone will engage with.
Well said. Can you read one of your poems? Then I want to talk about Peace Maps, which is a new book you have coming out.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'll read a poem from Peace Maps. Part of my goal, or who I am as a poet, I suppose, is the poet as witness. Witness to our own backyards as well as witness to the larger global moment, or witness to history, witness to issues of social justice and injustice. This poem really speaks to that on a lot of levels. It's called Sappho's Island.
Okay.
So Sappho was a very mysterious poet. She lived around 600 BC on the island of Lesbos, which is present-day Greece. And in the present day, there are a lot of refugees who have come ashore in Lesbos and other islands in the Mediterranean. It's created quite a huge impact with stateless refugees. And most recently, Lesbos made the news, not for Sappho, but because of the Moria refugee camp, where I believe 13 to 15,000 refugees of all ages had their camp burned down. So now they're homeless from the refugee camp.
Yeah.
And before that incident happened, I'd already created this poem. Sappho is quite famous because not all of her poems survived. They survived in fragments, and there's a lot of missing parts to her poems. So there are some missing parts in this poem. If there's a pause, that means it's missing. Words are missing. Sappho's Island. Poetry lingers in graffiti, torn ciphers, fragments of what happened or what might happen or what might never happen or secret. Poetry relies on space between breath, between words, between letters. Bodies that, between splashes of ink on, poetry relies on resonance between waves of love or hate or apathy or prayer. Poems are gestures of true moments, courage of a poet who signs her name with indelible ink. Beneath words, upon, between, beloved soldiers and refugees. When emptiness cannot be deciphered after ink has faded, papyrus burned, translations twisted, walls bombed to rubble, cave carvings eroded, after graffiti has been dissolved over and over and over with bitter tea and blood and flame, fragments of poems remain like tourniquets to mend our fatal hemorrhage of despair. So that's Sappho's Island.
Yeah. Interesting. I've been doing an online class with Angela Farmer, who's a poetry master, and she's now in her 80s, and she's doing a four-week Zoom once a week with doing yoga. She's on the island of Sappho's. She's in Lesbos.
So, oh, she is.
Yeah. She actually mentioned the refugee fires, the very first class we had.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And she said that there was a lot of noise that she said, I'm sorry for it, not usually noisy like this. And she just had a moment of silence.
Wow, well, that's one of those intense synchronicities, Blake. I had no... it's like we're less than 6 degrees of separation from an imaginary poem and something that's happening in real life.
I just want to take a quick moment to remind you that you're listening to Cartwheels on the Sky. This is Blake Moore, and I'm speaking with Albion poet Karen Lewis.
Well, you want to talk about your book, Peace Map?
Let's see. Well, I've got a lot of poems that have not been in the book before. I've published quite a bit in anthologies and journals, and I saw a call for submissions of book-length manuscripts, so mm-hmm. I sent in this manuscript. And Finishing Line Press, which is a small press located in Georgetown, Kentucky, asked if I'd like to have them publish my chapbook. So once I had that as a goal and a publisher committed to publishing it, I started thinking, well, which poems need to be in here and which poems need work? They gave me some time to revise and figure out what went in there. So the idea of maps, I had the title right away with the peace maps, because even though I may be writing about things that are difficult in the world, I feel that essentially most of my poems are leading toward a possible peace. And each of the poems in the collection is mapped, so there's GPS coordinates, which I was thinking,
for
a reader who wants to extend the discovery, they could look up these coordinates and learn more about Sappho's Island or Lesbos
mm-hmm.
or some of the other places. There's a few that just for privacy, my family's privacy, I didn't put the exact coordinates, but most of them have an exact coordinate. And that part of the process for me of ordering the collection was a new discovery for me. I like to add an extra layer to the puzzle of poetry.
How did you pick all the places?
Most of the places were places I've been. I have not been to Lesbos. There's a poem about Chernobyl. I haven't been to Chernobyl. I haven't been to Beirut. There's another poem there. So, but a lot of the poems came from my experience of particular places. So that was a fairly fluid process, I guess, to come up with that. Yeah, it's just a layer of the art, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So while most of the poems can be mapped to a particular place, there's also a lot of interiority to my poetry. And so those emotional places, you can't really define with GPS. That's why we need poems.
So very true. Did you want to read one more from that collection?
Okay, well, this one is, it's actually set at a site in Mexico, but it's close to my heart because I've been participating in the Noyo Center and Mendocino Land Trust calls to pick up plastics off our local beaches. We're so lucky in Mendocino County because we do not have too many plastics. We don't have quite the right currents to dump a whole gyre's worth of plastic on our shores. But that said, some really unusual stuff does wash up around here after the tsunami in Fukushima and Otsuchi in Japan a few years ago. There was some tsunami debris washed up on local shores, but mostly it's little stuff around here. However, when my husband Will and I were in Mexico a few years ago, it was on the Caribbean side, and there was so much plastic, it was mind-boggling. And the only way I could handle that was to write about it. So here's that poem. Sian Khan Biosphere. We are walking on a beach littered knee-deep in trash. This is a biosphere preserve with promises of shells, not trash. Plastic of every color and shape, blue lids from Agua Cristal. High tide delivers bountiful tons of barnacle-encrusted trash. On a beach so remote that few humans step ashore, the power of industrialized civilization scatters its message-laden trash. Behold the jagged edge of a colonized continent, ultimately abandoned to sea turtles, fishermen, mosquitoes, and trash. Planeta Azul, Cristal, Colgate, Clairol, Coppertone Sport. Too many castaway green lids, Inca oil bottles from Venezuela, trash. The copper tone is from Memphis and promises no CFCs. Infinite shards of plastic will poison creatures not evolved to eat trash. Mangroves provide sanctuary for Italian shampoo, Brisa, Kraft, Nestle Dominica, Coca-Cola, countless plastic combs, trashed. Random solitary shoes, flip-flops, heels, Nike, Adidas, each a refugee. Hopeful beachcombers will create new art from trash. But every tide brings more debris, a red lid claiming positive energy, Heineken's Green Star, doll parts, Rubbermaid, Pepsi, Noxzema, trash.
That reminds me of one of my poems. I just kept hearing that mine's about the Mendocino Coast, and I just was, it's another bit of an ode to what people leave behind on the beaches.
Oh, I would like to hear your poem.
Yeah, I guess I could. So it's called Highway Blue. Clear lapis rimmed in dull ivory, dotted with chert, bull kelp, and occasional jellyfish, cold sea rising, receding, rising, ignoring the footpath as it snakes from the gravel lot at the edge of the two-lane highway on the bluff above. Cars stop, stereos blare, motorhome squeeze into three spaces, start generators, fire on, fold up, gas barbecues. The old play Yahtzee in the early June breeze, while children in bathing suits tramp down to the shore, oblivious of temperature. Through it all, gangs of motorcycles pass like sentences out of a Hunter Thompson novel. Life on the coast is a string of adjectives held hostage by haphazard masses who drive to the limits of splendor to leave offerings of tall buds, empty Dorito bags, 32-ounce Gatorade bottles. A maroon picnic, red checkered plastic tablecloth, red forks, see-through cups, empty Gallo bottle, sits alone, an abandoned guest waiting for the sun to set. The beach doesn't care, the ocean callous, ungrudging toward the people dotting the seaside with consumer goods. At the trailhead, two ravens fight over a dirty diaper. I am the only one who isn't pretending not to notice.
Wow. Well, I would love to have a collection of just coastal ocean poems, I think.
That'd be a good idea. That should be your job, Karen. In your retirement, you could put that together.
Ocean poems.
I would work with you. Maybe it's our turn to put an anthology out. That'd be really fun. Maybe in the winter we'll talk about it again.
Or next year when
you're done with promoting your book. So is your book going to be available in the stores?
Well, apparently it's being mailed out to anyone who pre-ordered in the next week or so.
Uh-huh.
Gallery Bookshop in Mendocino will be carrying the book, and we have a launch party, a virtual book launch, on Sunday, October 25th, 3 p.m., at Gallery Bookshop.
Perfect. Or we maybe can send that to me, and I'll make sure I put that on the website so people, okay, if they want to. Is it going to be virtual?
It will be virtual.
Yeah.
We're working out the details right now. I'm trying to figure out, I'll need to pre-invite and send a link, et cetera, to people who want to participate.
Right.
We'll have a little bit of reading and then some Q&A.
Uh-huh.
And okay. I'm really looking forward to that.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. So the book was actually supposed to be released earlier in September, but this is kind of, we were very conservative projecting the date because I've heard of other people whose publications get delayed and then they show up for an event and there's no books. So we'll have plenty of books and plenty of community. Sunday, October 25, 3 p.m. at Gallery Bookshop.
Great. And if you send me the link, I'll put that all on the link to where the show archive will be, and hopefully people will tune in. I find the poetry community is doing a lot to create ways for us to continue to feel supported by each other, which is really wonderful.
It's so wonderful. And like you mentioned with your colleague that you're working with who's living on Lesbos, that the world in some ways can be smaller because we can have people come together who can't be in the same physical space.
Right. Oh, I haven't.
And even without the pandemic.
Exactly. I haven't stayed with Angela Farmer since, like, I want to say it was in the 90s in New York. So it's so great to be able to have this opportunity, and she's just as amazing as ever. She really influenced me back then. So to have the opportunity to study with her now is just an honor.
It's such a blessing to have such a thing happen. The world is in such turmoil, and if we focus on the trauma and the pain and the suffering, that's one role for poetry. But sharing is also another way to come together for healing, sharing through our poetry and through conversation. It's so special.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's so important. So very important. You know, that's what we're doing together.
Thank you so much, Blake.
Yeah.
That's what we've got. We've
right?
got real life. We can turn it into art.
That's exactly right. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Well, thank you for being available. It's just really
Thanks
wonderful.
Thanks so much, Blake.
Mm-hmm.
And that is it for Cartwheels on the Sky with Albion poet Karen Lewis. Next week will be Dan Roberts from Willits. Stay tuned for more great KGUA programming and have a wonderful evening. Stay positive and believe in yourself. And remember, love always wins.